Okay, this is our final hour of phone calls with Julian Cribb. Your reaction, plus I'd like you to share if you've ever been through a starving episode yourself. Maybe you were, you know, barricaded in the house or something. Share that story with us, too, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Julian, we were in the middle of talking about Monsanto, their ownership of these genetically modified seeds, and you were making your great comments.
Yeah, well, the concern is that if the rights to certain genes, which are naturally occurring genes, these haven't been invented by scientists, they're what occurs in nature, if they're patented and they're then incorporated in crops that farmers desperately need to combat the effects of changing climate, then those companies that own them will have a bit of a stranglehold on that market, and the seeds will not be readily available. And this is something that the late Norman Borlaug, who was America's greatest agricultural hero, the guy who actually engineered bred the short straw wheats. He used to warn about this, that we could not let the food supply fall into too few hands. It had to be opened and available to everyone who needs it. And he was a guy who helped to solve the famine problem in India in the 1970s by delivering these high yielding wheats. So he knew what he was talking about.
Yeah, sure did. Let's go back to the calls. Linwood, Washington. Bree is with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, Bree.
Yeah, hi. I heard you talking about actually starving. I'm 49 years old, and when I was growing up, I was on the streets of Chicago, and it was on the South Side.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm Caucasian, and it doesn't matter why I was on the streets. The point is that I was starving. I mean, there was like 2-3 weeks I didn't get any food at all.
Nothing?
I'd go to a dumpster and I'd find stuff.
Oh my God.
And that was what was going on.
Bree, tell me something about the hunger pain that you go through. I mean, how unbearable is it, and does it go away after a few days?
Well, it really isn't unbearable. What it does is it makes you very weak, and after a while, what happens is that you get used to it, and it actually becomes something that the only thing that stops you from continuing down that path is if you get so weak that you can't do anything about it, and there's no one around to help you. That kind of thing, you can starve to death, and I know of people in Chicago that did when I was growing up.
What was the worst thing that you had to eat just to sustain yourself?
I went into a dumpster behind a McDonald's, and there was a lot of hamburgers and things that they throw away. After a shift.
Yeah.
And I went back there and I scooped out some with my hands and I just ate that. And it was kind of warm. It wasn't really very good, but I was hungry and so I ate it. And a couple of times it made me really sick.
How did you turn yourself around? What finally happened for you?
Well, I got into a 12-step program. And then I did manage to turn my life around, because at a very young age I was drinking a lot of alcohol and using people up around me. And I got into a program, and that basically kicked me in the head. I'm one of those people that, to get my attention, sometimes it takes 2x4.
Yeah.
Well, you know.
Sound like you're going the right way now.
Well, I've been clean and sober for going on 29 years.
Good for you. Thanks for sharing that story, Bree.
Sure.
That's remarkable. Can you imagine having to live that way, Julian?
Well, it's terrifying. And a billion people do live like that right now. And if we're to avoid another couple of billion living that way, we need to take action.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's go back to the calls. We'll go to Ocala, Florida. Terrence is with us. Hey, Terrence, go ahead.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
My concern is not so much that there could be a famine, but the causes behind it. And what I've found is you take a horse and a donkey and you create a mule. So you've created something completely different. Monsanto has taken corn and it makes its own pesticide, but yet they continue to call it corn when it's no longer corn. They give hormones to cows to make more milk, but they continue to call it milk, but it's not milk. It's something else. So they're lying to us. You got Japan trying to catch every tuna on Earth and stockpiling it so the corporations can make profits on it. So it's between the governments and the corporations that are looking to make profits on things, even if it causes people to go hungry. So my concern is we're looking at for ways to grow more food when the problem is we got governments and corporations finding ways to make shortages in order to increase their profits. And that's where our battle is.
A lot of it, Julian, is all about the money, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Money is one of the big drivers. And the problem is that there is this market failure, that there's been this concentration of power in the hands of the supermarkets and the food corporations on the one hand and the farm input suppliers on the other. And this has really driven down the farmer's income and pushed up their costs. And that applies all the way around the world. And that just makes it so much harder for the farmer to do her or his job, you know, and to grow good quality food. And we have to turn that around, you know. It is a serious economic failure worldwide, and we have to find a way of increasing farmers' incomes that is going to enable them to husband the world's food productive resources.
Okay, next up we go to San Francisco. It's Anita's turn. Hi, Anita, go ahead.
Hi, how you doing, George? Good.
Great.
Nice to talk with you. Yeah, I think maybe we got it all backwards here. We don't want genetically modified stuff, and, you know, the companies would have us think that, yeah, we need this new improved version, but you figure how many millions of years we've been here, and we're used to the old milk. You know, we're going to have nothing but health problems and just like high fructose corn syrup, you know, all this new and improved, it actually turns out to be really something that our bodies are not accustomed to having to deal with. And so I think we should just get the word out that we don't want genetically modified, and just, you know, patronize our health food stores and you know, where the money is, that's where they're going to keep making stuff, you know. And out here in California, in San Francisco, we've got, you know, we've got our natural, our, you know, I don't want to say hippies, but, you know, people who are hip to the nature and sticking with nature and the, you know, the good old-fashioned way. And you can't just go switching things up on people. It's going to cause health problems every time.
Well, she may be right, Julian.
Yeah, there's truth in this. You know, half the Western consumers now die as a result of what they eat. So we need to seriously to address this one. You know, and we've got this great generation of overweight kids coming along at the moment. I think a quarter or something of the kids in the Western world are overweight, which means they're going to have shorter lives than their parents.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And that is a real shock, you know. So we certainly need to look at that one, that the total diet is not a healthy diet. I mean, for example, in our cities, poor people tend to be encouraged by government food programs to eat pre-packaged and processed foods instead of learning how to create healthy, fresh meals of their own. So there's a, you know, there are real problems in this regard. The other thing is that 1.5 billion of the world's 1.8 billion farmers are organic farmers. These are the smallholders of Asia and Africa and elsewhere who just have a small plot. They don't use fertilizers. They don't use. They just just use the natural way that people have farmed for hundreds or thousands of years. And they're very important people, and they need looking after because, you know, we don't want to throw them off their farms. We want to encourage them and give them ways of lifting their production that will enable their societies to be stable and survive.
What are the telltale signs that we know the impending famine has begun?
Well, we won't get much warning. As I say, it could start off just being a drought somewhere, and that'll drive up the price of grain, and then that'll drive up the price of food. And it'll all happen in a matter of weeks. And it could happen next year, or it might not happen until 2030. But as the resources for agriculture get scarcer and scarcer, each one of these successive famines, if you like, is going to be bigger than the one before. That's the issue. You're not going to see one mighty famine, one sort of biblical event. You're going to see a series of these things escalating, ratcheting up, and gradually, you know, making more and more impact on more and more people, especially, as I say, in the price of food.
Okay, let's go to St. Louis. Skyfire is there with us. Hey, Skyfire.
Hello. Long-time listener. Real interested in this topic. And I'm a culinary student. And in the next 15 to 20 years, the Midwest is supposed to have more culinary institutions than New York and Los Angeles combined.
Well,
And I'd like to know what is the culinary viewpoint, chef's the viewpoint of from the culinary field of this.
Well, we're going to have a lot of restaurants. That's the bottom line, Julian. But one day there may not be any food to serve in them.
Yeah, I mean, I warn in the book that the cookbook, you know, today's cookbook is actually one of the instruments of the coming famine, because you look at it, it's a beautiful document. It's got lovely photographs that lush, they make your mouth water, but it's actually encouraging you to believe that there is an endless supply of food, and there isn't. What we need are chefs and our cooks and our culinary experts, especially our TV and celebrity chefs. We need them to start putting out the message that people should choose the food that is sustainable. Food that is both healthy and sustainable. Instead of the stuff that is exotic and full of the things that are not good for you, they need to start putting a little bit more emphasis on foods that save water, on foods that don't degrade the landscape, on foods that don't need a lot of fossil fuel to produce. So I would like to see that emphasis coming out as part of the general education of the population. So people in the culinary world can be leaders in this coming revolution in food styles.
You know, we are spoiled right now, aren't we, in this country?
Oh, look, we have never had a richer and more diverse diet in the whole of human history. I mean, we make the ancient Romans with their great feasts look positively boring.
Yeah. Okay, next up we go to Mike in Ithaca, New York, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi, George and Julian and everyone out there. I want to say that, you know, I took a course in agricultural economics, and they talked about the concept of demographic shift. And that is when health workers like the Peace Corps go in, and they bring down the infant mortality rate. And once they get it down to 3%, no matter how rich or poor the people are, because they have new health care, cheap health care techniques for the babies, the people voluntarily limit themselves to 2 kids per family. You get zero population growth. But when these Peace Corps-like organizations run away, when it's between where they start around 30% and where they should finish when it's 3%, you know, once they get up down to 20%, they see the population rising because the birth rate is still high and the death rate is less. And then they get scared and they run away and leave them with intermediate partial development. And then the population keeps rising. And that's what's causing the world's population to rise. And if they stuck with it till the birth rates, or sorry, the death rates of the babies was down to 3%, population growth would go to zero.
Well,
if you just look up demographic shift in the encyclopedia.
Did you research any of that, Julian?
Yes, indeed. It's a very important point. As I say, the best contraceptive in the world is prosperity. As a family gets wealthier, they have fewer and fewer and fewer kids, and they educate them much better.
Sure.
That's how they invest in their future. So they might only have one or two kids instead of having 12. So, you know, that is So one of the solutions to world population growth is to overcome poverty. If we can overcome poverty, you know, we can just give people that kind of start, they will automatically control their own fertility. But the other one we need to do is help the young women, you know, who are they're doing this voluntarily worldwide. They're not having babies or getting married, but they get criticized. You know, they get criticized by people who have very strong views on how you should have, you know, big families and things like that. And that's not fair, because the people doing the criticism are old men, for the most part, and they don't have a say in the future like these young kids do. So we need to be more tolerant in our approach, allowing young women to feel that they're doing the right thing by the human race.
I'm looking at one of your charts, Table 11, about global population growth from 1950 all the way through 2050, and it is absolutely astounding. Where did the big jump come from? How did we go in 1950 from 2.5 billion? How did we jump now to 6.5? How did that happen?
Well, we were very successful at raising food production, and we also introduced vaccines and antibiotics. And both of those produced a dramatic reduction in the death rate, while the food supply produced a dramatic increase in infant survival. So we are actually dealing with our own past success in agriculture and medicine, and that's led to a very large population. We now need to change our thinking so that we see that we're part of this modern world which has got too many people to support in the long run. So we need to start, you know, working out how we're going to voluntarily reduce this population.
Kate is in Aubrey, Texas. Hi, Kate, go ahead.
Yeah, hey there. I've been really interested in all of the conversation here, especially in this last hour. You know, and I am a firm believer that pretty much it's the food conglomerates that do not want to see any kind of, promotion of techniques, which are absolutely very sustainable. I'm a master gardener, and one of the things, of course, that we are the most interested in is in educating the public regarding food choices. And there has been a tremendous interest here lately in, actually not just lately, it was really the whole concept of it hadn't been come up with until 1999 by a Columbia University professor who came up with this wonderful concept of vertical farming. And what that does is it primarily uses hydroponics. You can take any building, you can take one of these abandoned big box buildings, and by recirculating water, you can have a facility that grows crops 12 months out of the year, no matter if it's hailing outside, or no matter if it hasn't rained in 2 months, or it's 108 degrees. So, and growing indoors like that does a heck of a lot, because you are not relying on soils and nutrient-depleted soils. You're not having to use pesticides. You can very closely monitor the nutrient content of the food. And, you know, it's the nutrient-dense foods are the most tasty foods. When you have a exceptionally juicy, tasty tomato, it is chock full of nutrients. So all of these things can be monitored closely. And as a matter of fact, the rock star Sting has become enamored with this concept, and he is currently producing a documentary on it.
That's true. Good point. Well, stay with us, because we're going to come back with final phone calls with Julian Cribb, the author of The Coming Famine, in just a moment at Coast to Coast AM. And on our next Coast to Coast program, first hour, prominent civil and defense attorney Robert Shapiro joins us. He was part of O.J. Simpson's dream team and has handled some incredible clients. He will be here talking about also a major story that seems to be all over America and Canada as well. Younger people taking ecstasy, and it's a major problem. We'll talk about his Brent Shapiro Foundation. And then later on in the program, Yvonne Smith joins us with her latest work on UFO abduction cases and hypnotherapy. That'll be on Coast to Coast AM. I've kept you on so long, Julian, it'll be nighttime by the time we wrap this up, huh?
It is dark, actually, yeah.
It's getting there. Who are the heroes that you might have researched that are on the cutting edge of all of this? Are there any groups or individuals out there?
Yeah, I'd like to mention one person who I think is a real hero. His name's Bill Gates. Bill Gates has realized, as no government in the world has realized, that food is a critical issue. And he is throwing large parts of his computer fortune into solving the problem of food insecurity in Africa in particular. So there's a man who clearly understands what is going on. Let me give you an example. For example, a couple of years ago, this horrifying new disease, crop disease, came out of Africa, and it's already spread across Arabia, and it's spreading into Iran. It's on its way to India. This could destroy the world's wheat crops quite easily. And Gates and others are investing in the necessary science to try to defeat this rust disease that threatens the world's bread supply. And that's an example of the sort of thing that we really need. Citizens like that, putting their money into securing the human future.
Well, you know, that's one of a kind. He also supports vaccines.
I noticed that he's really ramping up his investment in agriculture. So I think as he's become more involved in the area of agriculture, he's understood more deeply the nature and the scale of the problem.
And what's causing it.
Yeah.
Exactly. Let's go to Tucson, Arizona. First-time caller, John. Go ahead, John.
Hey, George. How's it going?
Okay.
Hey, I'm a long-time listener, for the first time I've ever been able to get through to you guys.
Glad you made it.
I got a question here, and something I don't understand. Okay, we have the technology for desalinization plants. Aircraft carriers have almost every large naval vessel has them. But there's so few land-based ones, you know, where we have, you know, the room to build a much larger facility that can handle huge amounts of water, you know, converting seawater over to drinkable water, potable water, you know, water for crops, water for almost anything we need. Okay, with there being 70% water, I just never really quite understood why we didn't go that way, because with that being one of the causes, I'm in Arizona, and we're in a 20-year drought or something like that. So, I mean, I understand the problem here, but I wanted to get your guys' idea, you know, thoughts on that.
Well,
look, that's a really good point. Arizona is one of those places in the world that's suffering the double whammy in that its groundwater is sinking and it's getting less snowfall on the mountains to water it. So it's the kind of place that I'm talking about that is at risk in the world of the future. Desalinization, as I understand it, you need an enormous amount of energy to push the water through a rubber membrane, which filters out the salt molecules. And that's the problem with it. The fresh water you get out the other end is 3 or 4 times more expensive than the fresh water you're taking out of a rain-filled dam. So that's why, you know, local government and state governments and so on have been reluctant to invest in this technology because it's very pricey. But, you know, like all technology, the cost is coming down, and the more of it we make, the cheaper it will get. And I think it is a very important way of the future.
What's going on with forestry these days? We didn't talk about that much.
Well, the world was very concerned for a long time about cutting down all the forests, especially in the Amazon and so on. So they started putting back some of the forests. Now, we're still stripping the world of its forests, but at a much slower rate than we did in the past. But the impact that has on agriculture is it means that there's less new farmland available. So that's contributing to the shrinkage of the availability of farmland. So a lot of people point at Brazil and say, oh, we can grow all our food in Brazil, you know, but you've got to clear fell the Amazon to do that. And people have decided that's not such a good idea any longer. So forestry is, in fact, eating into farmland to some degree now.
Some of the points you talk about, rebalancing your diet towards foods that have a smaller carbon footprint. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, well, obviously we use a lot of fossil fuel to produce our food. Let's choose the foods that don't involve a lot of tractor fuel, a lot of long-distance transport and things like that. So Food Miles comes in here. Choose foods that are grown close to home. Choose foods that, you know, like vegetables and so on, which have much less fossil fuel embodied in them than grains or meat, those sorts of things.
Julian, did you hear about this 500 million egg recall in this country?
No, I didn't.
Oh, my gosh. Over the past couple of weeks, two farms, egg producers, 500 million.
Ah. Well, it's a bit scary, and it is the sort of thing that can happen in an industrialized agricultural system. I don't know, I was on a farm last weekend where he had 5,000 chickens out in the paddock, and they were wandering around, and that was a very productive farm, but the chickens were not constrained, they were not in sheds, and they were eating natural insects and grass as well as grain, and the eggs, I can tell you, tasted very much better. So I think that some of these natural systems, provided they're run scientifically, can also be very productive. So the people who say that organic farming is not productive, I think, you know, that's not quite true.
Fred is now in La Habra, California. Hey, Fred, go ahead.
Hi. I've met Native Americans that were rainmakers, and I've contacted National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association, and they said they voted to not work with rainmakers. And I am a seventh son, and you can contact me at roadsempire@yahoo.com, and I'll go anywhere and make it rain myself because I have that gift also.
How do you do that, Fred? Tell me.
I stay celibate for a long time, and I go and pray, and I get spiritual, and I put my spiritual friction on the upper atmosphere, and I've also met sun dancers also that bring out the sun.
You stay celibate and that helps it to rain?
I've lived a life of celibacy and have been the youngest of 9 children and 7 boys. Being a seventh son, I learned different than the firstborn or the secondborn.
That's
I see things in a different way.
That's different. Well, you know, Julian, maybe that explains in my particular case why wherever I go, there are thunderstorms everywhere.
Maybe you should try staying celibate more.
Unbelievable. I'd rather see some sun once in a while. Let's go to Jim, truck driving in Maine. There you go, Jim. Let's take your turn.
Hey, George and Julian, how you doing?
Okay.
You know, I wonder why that black cloud's following me around everywhere I go.
We got the same problem, don't we?
I guess. Yeah, I got a couple of points. Moses and Jesus fasted for 40 days and 40 nights without food and water, but you're saying that some people after a few days are going to want to kill people in the government. Why is that? Why are they able to fast 40 days and 40 nights? What do you think that is?
Well, you know, there are some people. There's a fellow in India who apparently has not eaten or has not drank anything in years. I don't know if that's really happening or not, Julian, but some people can do that, but they drink a little water, don't they?
Well, I think all living organisms require an input of energy from somewhere. So they must be getting their energy somehow. That's the first point there. But we could all fast quite a bit more than we do. As you know, Christians are more or less given up fasting, but it's still quite common in the Muslim world, Ramadan and so on, and it's quite often practiced in other cultures as well. It's a healthy thing, so, you know, it's got quite a lot going for it.
Okay, next up we've got Wayne in American Falls, Idaho. Hi, Wayne, go ahead.
Hi, George, how are you doing?
Okay.
It's really good to hear you, and thanks so much for having people like Julian on that are concerned about the most glaring problem that's facing humanity today. My question for Julian is, are you familiar, Julian, with Alan Savory and the Holistic Resource Management Program?
Yeah, I wouldn't claim to know all the details of it, but Alan Savory, when he was a young soldier in the South African Army, made the observation when he was out in the bush that the livestock, the great herds, the game herds of Africa, always moved. And he contrasted that with what happened to human herds, which ate down the pasture and the roots contracted and the soil got poor and it blew away. and he basically has preached a philosophy that if you operate on a much more natural system with your livestock, you will in turn enrich the soil, look after the whole ecosystem much better. So I think that's got a lot going for it, particularly because his system enables us to put more carbon back into the soil, and this will help to counteract global warming. So that's a really important dimension of it too.
I heard the man speak at the Elko Cowboy Poetry Gathering back in the early 1990s, and I'd really like to see George get him on the show sometime, you know, because he's really fascinating. He's like you. I mean, the guy thinks out of the box, and that was all my only question, so thanks so much, and I'm really glad that you know about him.
Thank you.
Okay. Any scientists truly at the forefront of this?
Well, there are many scientists, you know, but they're not getting the research funding, they're not getting the support that they need. I mean, Cornell University in the United States is probably at the cutting edge in many ways of food science. University of California at Davis, you know, those sorts of places have still got very great intellectual strength in this area. But they're not as strong, perhaps, as they used to be in many cases. And they're not getting resourced like they used to be because, you know, governments just don't think this is as important as it is. So we really need to get behind those guys because we don't want to run out of food scientists. That would be the worst thing that could happen.
All right, we go next to Florida. It's Ken's turn, east of the Rockies. Ken, go ahead.
Good morning, sir.
Morning.
It's a pleasure speaking to you. I consider you a consummate interviewer.
Thank you.
Julian, I've thoroughly enjoyed the conversation this evening, and one of the things that I think is the root of all of this is water. I think that nothing grows without water, and my mind raced to an experience I had in Bermuda a few years ago. As you know, Bermuda is an island nation, and all of the buildings there have oversized gutters with cisterns underneath the building to capture rainwater, and I think that we are missing an enormous opportunity in the world to not capture rainfall. I think it's an obvious source of water for all purposes.
I think you're absolutely right. We just let it run to waste. We let it get contaminated with whatever's on our streets, and then it goes into the gutters, and then we lose it. There's a Japanese public servant called Makoto Murazi who said that Tokyo ought to capture what he called sky water and put it in big systems under the buildings and then use it for growing vegetables and for flushing toilets and all of that sort of thing. So he sort of really started that thinking in Japan. In Australia, in the city of Adelaide, we take our stormwater runoff and we inject it into the ground, into the aquifer. So we've actually got a dam of water underground, under the city, where it won't evaporate and where it naturally cleanses itself. So any bugs and microbes that are in it actually die. So I think that it's called aquifer recharge or water banking, is going to be a very important technique so that we don't waste water in the future in our big cities.
I couldn't agree more. I think, especially in Florida, where we have considerable rainfall, we could be very independent in a lot of ways here with the water that we're wasting.
Yeah, well, if you've got good aquifers, you know, underneath there, and I think Florida, a lot of it's limestone, so you should have, then just recharge them with what's currently running off the roads.
Well, we're blessed, I suppose, compared to Arizona, for example, with the rainfall that we have and with the aquifers, because if you look at a topographic example of the state, it actually looks like a sponge. We have millions of miles of aquifers and fresh water under the state, but what's happened is saltwater intrusion has occurred, and so now, if you notice along the coastline in the state of Florida, a lot of the native plant life in that is dying because it's not accustomed to dealing with salt water. But in other places in the world, providing a system of cisterns under a new structure to collect rainwater would I think would be very beneficial.
Yeah, I think it needs to be part of the thinking when we redesign our cities, that every building should capture water and store it underground if possible, and the cities themselves should put it into the aquifer, to exactly as you say. Because if you take out more water from the aquifer than is naturally recharged in there, it will suck in seawater from some other, you know, if it's close to the coast. And that sort of saltwater intrusion can be absolutely lethal, especially if combined with sea level rise, which we're also experiencing. So this idea of storing our water is going to get so precious in the next 20 or 30 years. It makes an awful lot of sense, and it's not hard to do.
The ancient Romans knew about this. You know, they made some of the great old aqueducts.
They carried their water a very long way. They didn't necessarily store it very well. They stored it in big cylinders with lead pipes, didn't they, and poisoned themselves. But, the principle of managing our water much better has got to go around the world. We're very, very bad managers of water, us human beings.
I think so. Let's squeeze George in, Brooklyn, New York. Go ahead, George, real fast.
Yes, real fast. I just want to say that this environment that we're living in has been cross-contaminated so badly. The watermelon from 1960 used to be so sweet. You eat a watermelon today, you can't even taste the sweetness.
It's like eating liquid cardboard, isn't it?
Unbelievable. I say to myself, bring back my watermelon.
Well, there's a sign of the times there, Julian.
It is indeed.
Tell us a little bit about the coming famine and where people can get it.
It's published by the University of California Press, so on their website or at Amazon.com.
All right, very good. And Julian, thank you so much for being on the program. Leave us with one phrase of wisdom. What do we do?
Well, we can solve this problem, we human beings, but we've got to work together. We really have to put it together as a species. This is a challenge at the species level. It's calling on all our best qualities as cooperators, as people who can work together and overcome the differences that divide us to solve this one big problem.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. On our next Coast to Coast program, prominent attorney Robert Shapiro joins us. First hour, we'll talk about a number of incredible cases, including one of his major things that is so dear to his heart, the foundation of his son who died several years ago of a drug overdose, in a very sad, tragic story. And then later on in the program, Yvonne Smith joins us with her incredible story of hypnotherapy and alien abductions right here on Coast to Coast AM. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.